Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's session is Historic Preservation of Holden, Stewardship of the Built Environment, Holden in Context, What Makes This Place Important? Presented by John Lauber, number LAJ2003-04. Let's listen in.
Speak about the National Register of Historic Places and sort of the legal and historical background for historic preservation. Now we're going to start to focus a little bit closer to where we are and talk a little bit about Holden Village in an abstract sort of way. Holden has been determined eligible for the National Register of Historic Places based primarily on its first career as a mining village. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that preceded Holden's creation and contributed to the way it looks and was configured for the mining period. Here's a nice overview shot. These are all taken from a book of photographs that's in the in the bookstore by Larry Penberthy, who I think was a Wenatchee photographer. I'm not sure if you know Christopher. But he was an industrial photographer who took,
He worked here at Vermont.
Did he work here? Okay. He took extremely beautiful photographs of life here at Holden, and there's a nice collection of those at the bookstore. So these have been filched. But there's a view of the mill and the town site as they appeared in 1938. Holden, from the very beginning, sort of fulfilled two roles. The first was as an industrial site. It was a place where people came to work really hard. And we'll just run through these pretty quickly. These are some of the folks who worked in the mine. Had to drill the holes and set the charges and muck out the gravel and the big chunks of ore.
One thing that's always amazed me in these, John, is the fact that they were no sound devices or nothing to protect your ears at all. I expect most of the miners had to be pretty hard of hearing after.
They had a dentist, obviously.
OSHA would have a...
They don't have eye protection.
Right. OSHA would not.
They haul the stuff out in these little trams, and I don't know, maybe you saw there's still one of these up on the upper level.
There's the engine is up there, too.
The mill in its better days, and I think this is a ball mill.
Ball mill.
Where the stuff was pulverized. This is how they got it down to the lake. These big 45 tons, I think, containers that they hauled down.
Five ton containers.
Okay. And then put it on the barge and hauled it out to Chelan Falls, put it on the train and took it to Tacoma. So that's the mining side, but there was another side to Holden too. It was a place where a lot of people lived. And again, I'm just showing you these shots primarily so you get some sense of what this looked like 70 years ago, almost 70 years ago. You can see it's not a whole lot different. Another streetscape view. You must have climbed a tree to take this one. People have wondered what it's like in the winter. That looks like winter. I don't know. That's I'm in the hotel in a room like that. But I don't wear a tie or my shoes when I'm up here. But that gives you some idea what the rooms look like.
Steam heat,
Celotex siding or a wallboard, nice windows. Everybody had a view of something, even if it was the garbage house. The school, so I think a lot of you went to the open house there the other night. So there were kids up here, lots of families. There was a full medical facility. There's a dentist's office and a doctor's office, hospital, the dining hall. And you can see even that doesn't look a whole lot different from what it is today.
Same chairs.
Yeah. This is before the village center was.
Where is that?
That's where we go to Vespers. Where the play was. The soda fountain, lunch counter, bowling alley, pretty much looked like that last night. pool hall where I know you've all been hiding out. So that's Holden. But there were a lot of things that kind of led up to the way Holden was created initially. And we're going to start to bifurcate here a little bit. There were a couple of tracks that led to the creation of Holden Village as it was created in the 30s. It was a company town. So we're going to talk a little bit about company towns. It was a model company town. It wasn't just a town that grew up around an industry. It was a town that had some social engineering behind it. And it was an architecturally interesting place because there was a style of architecture used here that's called the rustic style. That was a very intentional creation. And we're going to talk about all three of those things today. We'll start by talking about company towns. Probably the first one in the United States that hit full flower was Lowell, Massachusetts, in the heart of the textile industry in the 1820s. It's one of the first industries to be heavily mechanized. So in that sense, it represents the arrival of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. Because it was a textile industry, at that time people felt that the only people who really had the knowledge to work in a place like that were women. Well, in 1821, women who were married didn't generally work. So what that meant was that the workforce in Lowell was made up largely of single women, and the companies felt that in order to attract that workforce, they had to provide housing, and they had to provide a morally upstanding community for those people to live in. So the community of Lowell has a number of these boarding houses. You can see that long building where these unmarried women could come and live. There were very strict rules about moral conduct and behavior and dress and all those sorts of things, all enforced by the company. The company owned the boarding houses. So it was a very paternalistic society. We move on about 60 years and we come to George Pullman, the Pullman Sleeping Car Company. I'm going to tell you a tangential story about that in a minute, but Pullman was headquartered in Chicago, which was the rail capital of the country. Good place to have a sleeping car company. And he became very worried about labor, his labor force. He had a huge number of employees. The 1870s and 80s were a time of labor upheaval. And he got the idea that maybe by creating a place where his labor force could be well cared for, he could avoid some of the problems with unions and strikes that other large manufacturers were experiencing. So he hired an architect, Solon Beeman, and a landscape architect, Nathaniel Barrett, who had worked on his own home, and had them design an entire community for his workers to live in. This is in Pullman, Illinois, and this is where I go off on a tangent. I knew about Pullman a long time ago, but I didn't know about Pullman, Illinois. I just knew about Pullman. So in 1987, I drove out here with a good friend of mine, and we decided that on our trip from Milwaukee to Washington, we would take one side trip. And I said, well, let's go to Pullman. We started in Milwaukee, but what I had in mind was Pullman, Washington.
That is a little out of the way.
We drove all the way out, you know, it helps do your research before you get in the car. We drove all the way out here, and somewhere along the way, we pulled off the road and headed down to Pullman and drove around town for about an hour and didn't come up with the company town any place. So finally went to City Hall and walked in and said, well, where's the company town? Illinois. Beeman and Barrett designed this company town. It was a fabulous place, designed in American Queen Anne style. All the buildings were made of red brick, and so they had kind of a similar aspect. Had a huge hotel, which you see sort of blurrily off to the left there, the Florence Hotel. Let's get a better look here. It had housing, it had all kinds of activities, a band, medical care, schools, recreation halls, all kinds of social clubs. This big market, which you see kind of off to the right, which is a shopping area, and then all the residential districts. 12,000 people lived in this place.
Was this for building the Pullman cars or people who worked the Pullman cars?
No, this is for people who built the cars. It was the manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And I think the way the Pullman company worked was that they actually sort of leased these cars to the railroads. I think they owned the cars even when they were on the rail line.
When does this take?
This would have been about 1883. This is the community was built between 1880 and 1883. But all in all, a pretty fabulous place. But there were many restrictions, much in the way that Lowell, Massachusetts had had. The people who lived in the properties had absolutely no right to do anything to them. The company took care of all the maintenance. The rents were fairly high. So even though there was this kind of nice climate, lots of activities and lots of amenities, the company really maintained tight control over this place. And remember, the whole idea of this was that it would avoid strikes by sort of proactively providing a good way of life for employees. Well, in 1894, after the panic of 1893, recession, when the Pullman Company and a lot of other companies did large layoffs and cut wages, there was a strike in Pullman. And you see the National Guard lined up here in front of the Marketplace building. So Pullman's great experiment worked for about 10 years, but I guess the lesson is that the social engineering and architectural design in and of itself didn't forestall the problem that they set out to forestall. So Pullman was an interesting experiment. At one point it was described as the most perfect town in the world.
What's it like today?
It hit really hard times. Pullman eventually was forced by the courts to sell off the residential areas because there was a kind of an antitrust movement said the company can't run a business and also extort money from employees, so they had to sell off the residential lands. By 1960, it had kind of fallen into decline, and a local group got together and has been systematically restoring the place ever since then. But there was about a 50-year period when it was really...
What is this? Is this a military?
This is the National Guard breaking up this strike in 1894.
Is this a historical preservation site?
Yes, it is. It's a national landmark.
Where is it in Chicago?
Kind of south and east. That was another sort of interesting thing is that it was not built right in the city, and that was part of the engineering thinking is that you separated this community from the main flow of life in Chicago, and that allowed you to exert a little bit more control over people's lives.
Is it still in existence?
Yes, it is, and it's been very nicely restored, most of it. Now we're going to talk about mining towns a little bit. This is a mining camp. This is sort of the first iteration of a mining town. This is in Goat Lake, Washington. I don't know where Goat Lake is, but I think it's over here in the Monte Cristo area between here and Seattle. But you can see it's not much of a place. But that would have been pretty typical, probably even here, of what kinds of buildings you would have seen, you know, in the very early prospector days. Then we move on to another stage in the development of mining towns. Virginia City, Nevada, it's a National Historic Landmark representing a boom town. It's just a town that grew up around an industry but wasn't owned by or built by or designed by a company. It's just a boom town.
It's a tourist place.
And a tourist place.
Tourist trap.
And now we move on to sort of the mining counterpart of Pullman, which is an architect design model copper mining town. I thought that was about as specific as you could get when we're talking about Holden. But this is a fabulous example. This is a community designed by Bertram Goodhue, who was probably best known as a member of a firm, Cram, Ferguson, and Goodhue, I think. Help me, Harry. You had to study this too, I think. Who really were noted for their Gothic Revival and exotic revival designs. But in about 1915, Bertram Goodhue left his parent company and hooked up with the Phelps Dodge Company, which was a mercantile company that also was deeply involved in copper mining, primarily in Arizona. And Arizona was just about to become a state and had a very pro-labor inclination in its newly formed state legislature. So Phelps Dodge was very nervous about what sort of legal structure might be created for its mining operations. We're afraid that, again, the unions would be heavily favored, that they'd start experiencing lots of union and labor problems. And so they actually moved to New Mexico, found a location near Tyrone, New Mexico, that had a much poorer vein of ore, but technology at that time would have allowed them to extract the minerals from that ore. They had developed the technology to step further. And they started with a blank slate and decided once again to create a mining town that would offer amenities with the idea that you could offset labor problems. So they hired this very well-known American architect, Bertram Goodhue, to begin putting this town together. He started by trying to imagine what sort of exotic revival might fit well in the New Mexico foothills, and decided that a colonial Spanish town would probably be a good fit. So you can see the plan for it here. It's very much a city beautiful plan, a very formalistic plan. You see a main axis going from left to right, lots of geometric shapes. So from the air, it's a very well-ordered and regular plan. Off to the left, you see a housing area, which is much less formal. That was a housing area for the mine supervisors. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute.
Where's the mine?
The mine was across a river. And that's another thing that we need to start thinking about. We talked about Pullman separating the town site from the manufacturing site. The town site was separated from the manufacturing site. If you think about Holden, you got the mill on one side of the creek and the town site on the other, and the mill is built one way and the town site's built another way. That's pretty typical, sort of a separation between industrial and residential areas. This is an overview of the, this is actually a drawing of the town site. The building off to the right is a large church, sort of a union church. The building off to the left is the Phelps Dodge Mercantile Store. Remember that this company was a copper mining company and a large retailer, so they made sure they had a good store there. When it came to housing, one of the strategies that Phelps Dodge employed in Tyrone was to have most of the supervisory staff be basically white men. And most of the people who worked in the mines were recent immigrants from Mexico. And so the housing was designed to strictly segregate those two groups. These are what are known as the American houses. You can see they're gabled roofs, many of them. Once again, picking up on some of the ideas of Spanish colonialism, adobe walls, fairly simple buildings. But these had indoor plumbing, they had spacious plans. They cost about $3,000 a piece to build, which at that time was a decent amount of money. And they had fairly high rents associated with them. The Mexican workers lived in the Mexican houses, which as you can see were, this is three houses in this illustration. Very small, they used outdoor privies. So there's a very strict physical separation in terms of both location of the American houses and the Mexican houses, but also a strict division in terms of how the houses were appointed. Let me move on to one that maybe is a little bit more akin to where we are today. This is the Kennecott Mines National Historic Landmark in Alaska, operated from 1911 to 1938. And it was known as a utopian town, but once you start, because the life there was really good. What we're looking at here is the milling area. When you start looking into the history of this place, you understand that in a way the life was good for only part of the people who worked at this place, which again was the supervisory staff and the professional class who tended to work in this milling site. They needed people who knew chemistry and geology and mechanical engineering and all those sorts of things. So it was a well-educated class of professionals, tended to be white men, and the life in this mill site was fabulous. The mine workers were allowed to rent parcels of land and put up shacks. That was the provision that was made for them. And the mine was actually about 10 miles down the road. This is what it looks like today. You can see that mill site in the background there. It looks a lot like the Holden mill site. This is a historic American engineering record documentation. Just showing what that mill site would have looked like in its better days. And some idea of what some of the accommodations would have looked like. If you look at the bunkhouse building, it's a bigger version, in a way, of what's here in Holden. But again, it had basic amenities, indoor plumbing, a nice clean room, those sorts of things. If you were a miner, your life was not quite so good. So that's a very quick look at some company towns and some mining company towns. And you can see there's quite a range there. But one of the recurring themes, I think, is that there was a lot of strategizing and social engineering going on, generally having to do with labor. You provided a nice place for people to live, and they were a lot more likely to stick with you in rough times and not cause labor problems. Now we'll look at one of the other tracks that I think led up to the creation of Holden, which is, we talk about this place as exhibiting the rustic style of architecture. Talk a little bit about the evolution of that style. It started pretty simply with stuff like this. This is Mesa Verde in Colorado. It's a town built into the side of a cliff. This is called the Cliff Palace. And it's made out of the same stuff that the cliffs are made out of. So this is rusticism at its very most basic. But there are other examples of this. This is Pecos National Monument in New Mexico. This is a Spanish colonial site overlaid upon a Native American site. This is an adobe construction, where once again you literally take the dirt out of the ground and pile it up and you've got a building. This is closer to my territory. This is an Ojibwe birch lodge made out of saplings, bent, poked into the ground, bent over, and protected from the weather by sheets of birch bark. And then the one that we all think of when we think of rustic, I think, is this pioneer cabin. There's some of them here in the valley. If you want to get a flavor of it, you can go down and look at the River Sona, which is a latter-day version of a pioneer cabin. But once again, all the stuff this is made out of is stuff that you basically found wherever you lived and turned into a building. In this country, in about the 1840s, the architects began to get involved in creating a uniquely American style and looking at their surroundings and trying to make some hay with those, turning them into some sort of architecture. And one of the first people to really grapple with this whole realm was Andrew Jackson Downing, who came out with a book in 1840 called Cottage Architecture. That began to look at creating rural buildings that would fit into their natural environments. bear with me for a minute, I'm going to try to read you a couple things. One of the things that Andrew Jackson Downing really had a thing about was the use of wood. He felt that in most buildings, wood was used in a way that was not honest. He put clapboards on a building and they're going horizontally. And he said trees don't grow horizontally, they grow vertically. So one of his defining characteristics was the use of board and bat and siding. He said by putting those boards on vertically, you're being more honest to the material because it looks like a tree. Another thing he had a strong aversion to was the use of certain colors, primarily the color of white. I'm going to read you this excerpt. There's one color, however, frequently employed by house painters, which we feel bound to protest most heartily against as entirely unsuitable and in bad taste. That is white, which is so universally applied to our wooden houses of every size and description. The glaring nature of this color, when seen in contrast to the soft green of foliage, renders it extremely unpleasant to an eye attuned to harmony of coloring. So he was starting to think about how to make a building fit in with nature. A few years later, the railroads started to reach into wilderness areas, and one of the first places this happened was in the Adirondacks of upstate New York. As soon as there was railroad access to or near these wilderness sites, people wanted to go out there to experience the rustic life. And so they started to build camps, literally camps, canvas-roofed constructions like this in the 1870s, where they'd go out and spend a week, you know, shooting animals and living a rustic life and eating pancakes, I suppose. But by the late 1870s, the rail lines were well established. There were roads that led from the rail lines up to some of the fabulous mountain lakes. Some of the railroad companies decided that they could develop that camp life into an economic boon for themselves. So one of the first people to take on this task was a guy named William West Durant. You see him here at his outpost in the Adirondacks. He built four camps on Racket Lake in upstate New York, and is really credited with sort of formalizing what we now call the rustic style. You can see some elements of it here. Let's look at some more pictures. One of the characteristics of his camps was that they were complexes of buildings, or collections of buildings. There were a number of reasons for this. One is that these camps were generally owned by fabulously wealthy people who invited all their friends up for the summer and wanted to be close to them, but not too close. So they, by creating compounds and buildings, everybody had a little bit of privacy, and yet there was some proximity as well. If you start looking at the plan of this and the plan of Holden, you see a few parallels there, I think. Another reason for dividing the, instead of building a grand hotel or something, is fire safety. If you have 20 buildings and a fire affects one of them, you still got 19 left. If you have a grand hotel and fire affects it, you got nothing left. So there were some practical reasons for this planning theory as well. Durant was a master of using natural materials, and I think really gets a lot of credit for establishing some very important precedents. Again, I'm going to try to read something to you. Durant's simple design took the best features of the Adirondack's early log cabins and combined them with decorative features of the long, low Swiss chalet, making a building style that blended perfectly with the woodland or lakeshore setting. One comment. The use of structure as a decorative element, that's something we see at Holden and something you see here as well. We've got a porch here, a porch railing, made out of natural materials. But also used, you know, it's not just a post and a railing, it's parts of trees carefully selected and cut and peeled and polished so that you end up with a decorative effect. there were some accommodations to the weather. It was a drizzly place a lot of the time. So again, you have this compound of buildings all sort of loosely connected. So there's some togetherness and some separation as well. This is a way to get to the lake, from the lake to the lodge. These are all Camp Pine Knot, built in 1878, while remaining protected from the weather. But you see that you've got these trees kind of poking up all over the place, and the vertical poles that are part of the structure of this walkway really kind of reflect that, those trees. This is an interior view. Again, the exposed structure, use of heavy stone, logs. This is really the beginning of this rustic style that we're thinking about.
Is that still in operation?
Yep. This is owned by a college. It was again, fell into decline and was given to a college, I think in about 1960. It has been operated as a sort of convention conference center since then. On the other end of the country, a little bit later, once again, the railroads were expanding, and they carried freight and they carried agricultural goods, but they also carried people, and there were some fabulous sites along those new rail lines. This is a postcard view taken from a book put out by the Great Northern Railway, showing the gateway to Glacier Park. I came past this on my way out. This was built in 1913 as a destination for the railroads. The railroads built the hotels, built these rustic style gateways, and then promoted them as sort of exotic portals to the wilderness. So they wanted these buildings to look different from a building in downtown Chicago. Here's a view of the Glacier Park Lodge in 1913. Those columns in the front are Douglas fir trees, entire trees, set on end and used as structural elements. Probably one of the more famous rustic style railroad buildings is the Old Faithful Inn at Yellowstone Park, designed by Robert Reamer in 1903. It's known as the largest log structure in the world. A fabulous construction that went up in Yellowstone. You would arrive at Mammoth, which is the north entrance of the park, and then there were settlements about a day's stagecoach drive apart. If you go to Yellowstone today, that's still where most of the activity takes place. You've got Mammoth, Canyon, Lake, Old Faithful, and Madison Junction are kind of the stops, and it was designed so that you could come in on the train, hop onto a YP Company stagecoach and take a 5-day trip and make your loop around the park. And at each one of these places, there was something like this. They varied in style, but...
The interior of that lodge is probably one of the most amazing things we've ever seen.
Yep.
Yeah.
And again, you see that influence of William West Durant. All the structural elements are made out of trees. I mean, you know, all the structural elements in any wood frame building are made out of trees, but not quite so explicitly. And that massive five-story stone fireplace. So you walk into this place and, you know, you're really not in the wilderness here, but you kind of feel like you are.
Would that
kind of
building burn down or something?
No, during the big fires of 87, they worked really hard to protect it, but it's still there.
It's still there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed there last year.
We left it in good hands.
Yes.
This is a slide of convenience, and I don't know that it particularly follows the flow here, such as it is, but I wanted to show it to you anyway, because there were other movements taking place in the early 20th century that were very naturalistic in nature as well. This is the Joshua Melson House in Mason City, Iowa. Designed by Walter Burley Griffin. It sits in a ravine that runs through the middle of this small Iowa town that has limestone outcrops all up and down the sides. And it was an attempt to sort of pick up on that natural flavor and build a building that would just look like it grew right out of the ground. And I think it's a very successful effort. But many of the Prairie School architects were thinking in a, the results of their thinking were different from the rustic style, but the sort of ideas were the same, which is you look at what's around you and you try to design a building that fits into the landscape. So this is another sort of parallel movement that was going on at the same time. Now we're going to move to another part of the country. Somebody the other day talked about Thomas Moran's paintings of Yellowstone Park. This is a Thomas Moran painting of the Grand Canyon, made in the 1870s. Very romantic view of that area, showing the color and the stone and just what an amazing place it is. And this is the kind of thing that went back east and got people interested in traveling out to that sort of unseen west. Well, Santa Fe Railroad eventually built a rail line into the Grand Canyon area and hired a woman from St. Paul, Minnesota, Mary Jane Coulter, to help design destinations, much in the same way that Yellowstone or Glacier were destinations for train travelers. Mary Jane Coulter was hired to design destinations for people headed to the Grand Canyon area. And so she developed a type of rusticism that's quite different from what William West Durant came up with. But if you see some parallels here, I think with the Nelson House in Iowa, again, this just looks like it grew right out of the ground. This is Hermit's Rest, built in 1914 for the Santa Fe Railway Company. It was about a 10 or 12 mile stagecoach ride from a train depot, and gave tourists a destination point so they could take the train to the Grand Canyon area and then go to this place. You can see some details here. Mostly use of stone, but some wood elements as well. The interior. And a stairway taking you from the canyon up to the rest.
It's a north rim, isn't it? North rim?
I have not been to the Grand Canyon, but somebody here had on a Grand Canyon hat yesterday. Was it you, Sharon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were.
Which rim are we on here?
These are on the south rim.
Yes?
Is it? Okay. I don't remember seeing that.
I thought it was north.
But I remember the name, like, as she must have done other things there on the north
rim. South.
This is another, this is Lookout Studio, built about the same time in another part of the park. But again, sort of the same idea. You can see that the building itself, you almost have to look hard to find it. Grows right out of that rock face. And this is a building that went up about 30 years later, once Grand Canyon was under the administration of the National Park Service. Same ideas. These are all Mary Jane Coulter buildings. She used her inspiration for that tower was a Anasazi Indian cliff dwelling that had a round tower in it that she picked up on and sort of recreated for this lake commission of hers in 1932. So those are some sort of precedents for early rusticism. Then in the 30s, something happened that really pushed the idea of rustic architecture forward very quickly, and that was the Great Depression. A lot of people were out of work, and so the government put together a whole series of make-work programs, among them a program known as the Civilian Conservation Corps, where young men were allowed to enlist in this agency, and then were set out into wilderness areas to do everything from trail building to construction of state park buildings. This is a group that was at Jay Cook State Park in Minnesota. This is a program that was administered by, sort of jointly by the federal government through its Works Progress Administration, the National Park Service, and the U.S. Army. So you really enlisted in this program. They did great work. You went off, you learned some basic skills. Here's somebody learning to use an axe. And, The next shot was showing with an amputation below the knee. Here's an example of what these guys did. Mostly they were young men, but they were always skilled artisans who were in charge of these work crews. So the ideas and the execution, the ideas were, the supervision was provided by very skilled people. The grunt work was done by the Mavericks, I think it's fair to say. This is a building that's in Itasca State Park in Minnesota. It's called the Old Timers Cabin. If you look at this carefully, you'll see that the walls consist of four very large white pine logs. Just an amazing structure, all done in a Swedish log construction. This is at Gooseberry Falls State Park, the use of massive stone walls and a pole roof structure. This is an example of a completed building at Gooseberry, using Lake Superior stone. Well, with the advent of the CCC, the Forest Service and state park systems all over the country and the National Park Service scrambled to come up with plans that could be executed by this huge workforce. In 1933, the Forest Service hired its first ever system-wide architect, a guy named W. Ellis Groban, who began to develop a series of standard approaches. These are plans of specific buildings, but he did a series for each Forest Service region, dividing them up into desert, grassland, woodland, and alpine style buildings, trying to provide some guidance as to how buildings in each of these types of terrain should look. On the left, we have a ranger station in Estes Park, Colorado, and on the right, we have a ranger station that's in Arizona. I can't tell you exactly where. But they came up with these standard plans or standard approaches. You can see that the materials for these two different natural settings are very different, but appropriate to each of the locations. In 1935, the Park Service issued a three-volume book, Park and Recreation Structures, edited by Albert Good, who was an architect for the Park Service, as you can see here. It did very much what Forest Service had been doing, but they basically cataloged rustic-style buildings from all over the country. So this three-volume work contains structures from state parks, national forests, national park sites, all kinds of places, and it's a very thorough book. It's about 3 inches thick. And it has designs for everything from drinking fountains to site plans for a recreational, an entire recreational complex. So sort of all aspects of planning were included here. And then examples were depicted through drawings and photographs. And what this did was it really codified the rustic style and established it as a real thing. So it wasn't just individuals sort of off doing their own versions of it. There were some parameters for people to follow. So that's sort of the quick, that's where it all came from. I want to show you that this legacy still endures. This is Two Harbors, Minnesota. Rusticism is alive and well. This is Lou's Fish House. And if you look closely, you can see that it's a log building. Sort of. It's a T111 plywood building with log notching painted on the sides. And right next to it is the Holiday gas station, which is a sort of bungled attempt to look northwoodsy with the stone and half log siding, and then that weird gable that doesn't go anywhere in front. But again, you know, this is sort of stamped in our heads as what you should see when you're in a wilderness area.
Do you have a slide of the nearby house? Sir?
I don't. I think I may. That slide shouldn't have been in there, but let me go back to that one. I showed you the Melson House earlier. You can see what an organic architect did in early 1900s, 1914. and what Frank Gehry did about 10 years ago in Minneapolis. In a way, it's the same setting. You've got a Mississippi River gorge on the left, and we've got Willow Creek on the right. But if you squint a little bit, you can see that these are both attempts to sort of take a natural environment and somehow reflect that in your building.
What is that?
It's the Weissman Art Museum at the University of Minnesota. And people either absolutely love it or absolutely hate it. My kids call it the Tin Man Building. I really like it. I think it's
interesting.
Yeah. This is a little more somber example. This is a new building at Gooseberry Falls State Park up on the north shore of Lake Superior, designed by a Minnesota, a Finnish-American named David Salma. It's about 5 years old, and I think a very nice modern rendition of the rustic style. You can see, once again, we've got massive timbers, massive stone construction, an interior shot here. The clerestory in the roof, the structural elements are used to sort of suggest walking through the trees in the wilderness. So there is a very quick and breathless attempt to show you how maybe some of the things that we see at Alden got to be here. This is very much a work in progress, as I'm sure you've figured out, but it's what I'm going to be thinking about for the next few months as we work on some preservation ideas here in Alden.
Where did the log house fit in? That's what we built up eastern Montana, you know, that's what we had.
Well, the sod house. Now, you know, I should have pulled one of those up too.
Yeah. You'll have to have some.
Well, send me a family. send me a family picture. Questions or comments? In tying it to Holden, I guess I think when you go out of the building, I mean, we're sitting here. You can see the peeled logs here. This is a 60s remodel, so this isn't, you know, early rustic style, but somebody was still picking up on the idea. But if you walk around the village, you'll see the use of a lot of texture. Each of the buildings has more than one kind of material on the outside. It's very rough. They didn't try to plane the boards or make smooth surfaces. They sort of thrived on that texture.
I would like to know who did the work, who built the homes. It wasn't the miners themselves,
no,
was it?
No, there was an architect from Wenatchee named Ludwig Solberg, who designed them, and then maybe you know, Christopher, if there was a contractor or if it was my employees who actually did the construction.
There was construction crews that were skilled in doing that, and whether they were hired by the mining company or a contractor, I don't know.
So anyway, it was a private company, a private contractor.
Well, it was a private architect hired by the mining company.
Yeah.
But yes.
I have a question about the remodeling that you've done here. For example, you have a sound system with microphones. You have a fire extinguishing units and everything. Have they made after fact drawings of all these things? Do you have them in records here?
I'll let Christopher answer that. He's the keeper of the drawings.
Well, this remodel we're in right now is done, as John said, in the 60s. And we have some drawings, but not accurate record drawings. All the more recent remodels, we have accurate record drawings.
How about everything like outside, utility things, valves and so forth? Did they do good drawings of those?
Most of that's been redone since the original infrastructure in the 30s. And all the new work we have good record drawings of. The old work we have adequate drawings of.
Yeah, I've been concerned with areas where they didn't do this very well. Creates a problem.
Yeah, I think you got two people who could vouch for that.
You experienced some of those problems.
So was this built? I mean, did they decide? Obviously, they did all the footwork for the mine and stuff. But did they just build the village and then bring in the miners, or did they sort of build some, bring in some miners, bring in more?
There are a number of stages in the evolution of the town site itself. Probably the first settlement was up near Honeymoon Heights, on the side of the mountain, because that's where the first ore came out, and that goes way back. I mean, there were cabins up there from the 1890s. And the work down here was a little bit later. But while the town site and the mill were being constructed, some people lived in Honeymoon Heights, and then there was another camp, I think, sort of between here and the family campsite, that really was sort of a mining camp. It was a staging area while this stuff went up.
So that was active mining in progress.
The mining was in progress while this village here was being built, because they were driving the tunnels and breaking up some of the early ore. So until the village was actually ready, the miners were still working in the mine. Probably not the number that finally worked in there when it got into full operation. There was mining going on while this was being built.
It's obvious that they tried to make people happy in a community here. And since the Holden operation started in the mid-depression, or the late part of the depression, they must have had people eager to work in the mines and have a good family.
Yeah, I think this was seen as a real economic boon to the entire area. But there was some social engineering that went on here. If you think about it, we're looking at a town site where if you had a family and were on sort of supervisory staff, you had a house. And if you were unmarried and 25, you lived in a lodge. And if you had a family, you either lived in a shack at Lucerne, or you went down the road and built a house at the Winston town site. So there wasn't really provision made in the company thinking for those sort of the middle group, the people with families. And I suspect that some of that was that paternalism again. If you have 25-year-old single guys, you kind of want to ride herd on them a little bit if you're counting on them to get the ore out of the mine. So they were in town. There were restrictions on sale of liquor up here. They had lots of activities to keep people busy. It was a good place to live, but it was somewhat of a controlled environment as well. Again, that separation between the industrial town, the mine mill, and the mine itself, and the town site. Other things you might want to notice as you walk around are just the use of those large peeled logs as structural elements on the porches, the steep pitches on the roof, which is to help shed snow. We live in a high snow load area. Every building has some kind of an entrance porch. If you've been here in the wintertime, you know why, because with this much snow on the ground, if you didn't have an entrance porch, you couldn't get the doors open. So the rustic style was a practical style to a certain extent, but also designed to make this half of the valley fit into the natural landscape a little bit.
Do you know if the company had its own water transportation?
On the lake?
Yeah.
I don't know if they owned, I think they owned the whole thing down to Chelan Falls. I believe they had a barge and a tugboat built for the company.
Yeah.
Just about that. You know, Don, I think the company
owned it. I don't know about transporting people back and forth, whether that was the Lake Chelan Boat Company contracted to do that, or whether the company had some kind of facility. That I honestly don't know.
But as far as the ore, the company did.
Well, yeah, the ore, that stuff. They had their own barge and system for taking the ore barrels in and out.
Did they have a company store where families bought food and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Peter Rabbit, was it, or something like that?
Yeah.
So they didn't have to depend on the barges to bring their food in.
Well, yeah, that's how it got to the company store.
There was a company store?
Yep.
Yeah.
The end of Lodge 6
was
a store.
Oh, I see.
And then you have to remember that you can send an order out one day and probably have it back the next, with any luck at all, or within a couple of days, certainly. So.
But they still had the miners in Vessel.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think they ran, it was open 24 hours.
The dining hall was open 24 hours a day because the mine operated most of the time, at least 5 days a week, 24 hours a day.
And if you look at the end of the dining hall, you'll see, six huge coffee urns. It's clear that Holden Village has always run on coffee.
I noticed in that one picture there were only four.
No, I think there were
probably
the rest of the people. I thought, well, he must have added a couple. We have a friend that lived here and went to school here, and Joe tells, he liked it. It was great. He did, has good fond memories of living here. His dad was a miner.
They had fun.
Oh, yeah.
Probably some wild times.
I haven't talked to a single person that didn't enjoy their life here. Maybe the disgruntled ones don't come back, but. But yeah. Most everybody you talked to thought this was a wonderful place to work and grow up.
Yeah, they had a bowling alley.
Well, sure, they had lots of recreation. They had basketball teams, and they traveled. The company provided transportation to go out and play other teams, yeah. And further out. The baseball field, the same thing. They brought baseball teams in, and the baseball team traveled out to play other places. So.
That's great, kids.
And tomorrow, if the weather's nice, what I thought we'd do is just walk around a little bit and take some deep breaths and look at some of the buildings and try to remember some of this. And as I said, we'll look at some of the, you know, intact older stuff, but also some of the things that have happened more recently that have been changes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay.